Do you want to talk about who we are first? Because that's the first thing that I think it's important to tell you.
Get to the simple things first.
Yes.
So I'm Daryl. I work for Datacom. I'm in the BI team in Auckland. We're a Microsoft Gold partner. And I've been working with, been fortunate to work with PowerCo because, as you'll see as the session goes through, it's been a really interesting project. My interest has always been in data. If I go back in my IT career, it's always been about, initially mainly transactional databases. But once I managed to make the leap across to dimensional databases and look at analytics, I realized that was certainly something that I wanted to be involved in. So I'm quite fortunate, I think, to have the role and work for the company that I work for because we get to do some pretty fun stuff.
Yeah. That's right. I'm Igor. I forgot to tell you, you play the piano.
Well, almost.
He tries to. So if you want to engage into...
I'm able to separate the black and the white keys at this stage.
Yeah, that's right. That's an important thing.
One thing I did forget to mention, Igor, is that, yes, my accent is, in fact, Browns Bay. So.
Oh, that's right. I can show you a map about that. Igor, Albert, or Igor for short, worked for PowerCo, has been PowerCo a team player for over 6 years now. And I do lots of things. Tricky and nice things. I'm called an architect lately, but don't ask me which type. You know, is architecture session, is it your solution or your business or an enterprise? I just do a lot of stuff. For those of you not familiar, and I think it's most of you of the industry, we do deliver power down to the about 320,000 customers. Across the country, and gas to about 100,000 from Coromandel down to Wairarapa, so we're all over the place in the North Island, and we're kind of an old but at the same time new company in terms of culture, and kind of small and keep quiet, but until we hit the stage with these kind of things.
I was just about to say, we now finally know where all those customers are.
Yes, we do now. So that's us. To know who are you guys? So, Daryl, do you have some questions you want to ask?
Yeah, I think we just wanted to get a sense of the audience. So we just want to have an idea of who are architects, as in enterprise architects and or business architects, if just by show of hand, if we could see here. And CIOs or IT, heads of IT over there. And then just the rest of the audience, just give us a sense of the BI consultants, DBAs, BI consultants.
Good balance.
Yeah. Are there DBAs here today as well? Yeah. Okay. That's a good mix. And then just general interest in BI, obviously, but specifically geospatial. Do we have lots of geospatial skills here today? Yeah. Great. Oh, that's good. Excellent.
Good.
Yeah.
Good to end on that note, because this is not just the project between PowerCo and Datacom, or a journey, as you're going to see, between PowerCo and Datacom. We have quite a few other partners involved in this. GBS, anyone in the room from GBS? He's somewhere around. It's one of the companies we've been working on. Some of the stuff you're going to see is hosted in the Eagle JS Cloud on IBM, Eagle guys back there, and some of the S3 products, and Locus, who distribute some of the stuff that we use in this. So, as you're going to see, it's going to be a bit of a mix. And that's why it's eclectic. So we're going to talk about that. So what's the journey?
Yeah.
About?
So we found that, first of all, we wanted to expressly thank you for choosing this session over many other good sessions that are happening at this time. But also, we've identified that it's often very difficult to wow an audience like this with technology, because let's be honest, we've all seen it, and we see the pre-release, and then we come to Tegit and we see the final release, and it's kind of the same. So we thought we'd take a slightly different tack on this presentation and just talk about the journey and the process, and focus a little bit less on the technology. You will see technology, you will see the things that the tools that we've used and how we've done that. But it's unlikely that we've done anything that anybody else in the room wouldn't have done, posed with a similar problem. But what we'd like to convey is what was actually happening behind the scenes. What were, you know, what were the issues, and who did we have to contend with, and some of the interesting contract issues we've even been able to encounter over this time. So it's not a flash presentation in the sense that we're going to show you things that you've never seen before, but we certainly will show you some good stuff. We'll show you some bad stuff, and obviously the awesome stuff.
Yes. But it's also, to me, a journey about piecing together stuff that from a user perspective, from a business perspective, has always been a part. So that's why we have that picture, and I have this puzzle in my hands. So one of the goodies that we're going to give away today is this puzzle, because it really represents what we have been doing here. It's kind of putting together pieces that don't really fit or didn't really fit from a user perspective and from a technology perspective and from a just a conceptual point of view. So it's about bringing together old and new stuff. So it's using cloud as SQL 2012 with really old legacy stuff that we mesh together and kind of visualizing that in different ways. So that's why we call that eclectic BI. It's that mesh, that blend. And so please ask questions, and the better questions, the more interaction we'll have and the more information we'll have, and you'll have the ability to play with these toys that I have there.
Good stuff. All right, let's get on with it. So the first thing we wanted to talk about was the business challenges. And very often, certainly as a consultant, I'll come into a BI project when there's already work being done. This project was no different to that. We went into an environment that already had data warehousing, and that was good and solid, and it had its purpose. But we were approached with this project, and essentially what we needed to try and build was a single view of the entire organization across any kind of layer that you could imagine the business wanted to analyze. And typically where things weren't necessarily related. So we have a financial component to, you know, merged with something like a customer complaints component. So the project was initially very, very exciting. I remember seeing the first slide deck of the presentation that was given to me by the project manager who had taken the project, Paul Ward. And I just looked at it and I thought, wow, this is kind of a BI person's dream come true. Mm. But what I think would be useful to talk to, Igor, is what was actually happening in the background? What was going on in the business that this actually came into existence? Because as you said, you've been in the game for a long time. Mm. So you must have been doing your business. So why was there this huge lack? And that always is interesting to know that bit of the conversation.
Yeah, so we didn't have that view that you kind of picked up from the beginning in terms of saying it's about that great ensemble, if you want, from our businesses. We had a lot of small problems, and I think everyone in the room will relate to within the organizations having, you know, we need to improve this system or that view, or you need to be able to pull this from there and have a proper architecture at some point and do a lot of work on it. But the source of this was different drivers, different, should I say, engineering drivers, financial drivers, more of a performance driver. So there were different needs that were coming together. And I think it's that timing that that just made that perfect combination, if you want. So we had old systems that we needed to replace, or we had new requirements from the context, from our drivers, like regulatory requirements. We had the technology changes. We had quite a few things coming into play. So I think it was a good timing, good alignment. But it is without the driver of the real business, this would have been impossible. So it's that business requirement that drove this all together.
So you're saying at a point you had what we encounter very often is these siloed systems where engineers can't talk to planners directly. There was a lot of data manipulation.
It's like, you know, you had people pulling information manually from one system and going and building their own view of that data into typical Access data warehouses, anyone. those, and then building Excel spreadsheets out of that, and then building that information into a proprietary GIS system, and then trying to link stuff, and then derive decisions from there, weeks or not months down the road. So that's a kind of challenge that we're facing. So it's complicated manual work, long-term investment in people, controlled systems, and we're trying to move away from that.
Yeah, and I can attest to that as a consultant on the project, going to those business users to sell them a BI solution was often quite tough because they were in this position where they'd been working so hard to get their data prepared that they already had systems. They already could answer their questions. It was just that it was taking 7 to 14 days to answer a question, possibly at which time the question was irrelevant.
So when you looked at those users, those databases, what appear to you in terms of challenging?
Well, yeah, I think, as I mentioned in the intro, what I found certainly was every BI person's dream. We found everything. We found no less than 12 source systems. One of those source systems that we've worked on has at least a 12 gig extract per run. So we certainly had huge volumes of data. When it came to, we found diversity in infrastructure, in systems, as well as applications, as you can imagine. As I said, nothing unusual. I'm sure most of you would have encountered that as well. We had proprietary databases. One of the databases, in fact, as an external consultant, I'm still not allowed to see. I have to give my request to Igor.
I can tell about it.
he can see it, but I'm not allowed to see it. So we've got some CEO somewhere in America pondering a contract that'll allow me to see it. And so that's just a little heads up if there's any project managers in the room. You certainly want to get to that quickly. Yeah, we found huge volumes of data, complex systems, including systems that are telemetry-based. So not just OLTP systems, so not just financial systems or even GIS as complex as it is. SCADA systems, if any of you have worked with it, you know that SCADA is telemetry, so every time a switch switches on and off in any device in the network, it records that. So you can imagine there's thousands and thousands of transactions. Not only that, that data is incredibly cryptic because, you know, people don't normally look at that information. And yet for us it was particularly important. So we had to sit with engineers to decrypt those bits and pieces. We also, as you can imagine, we also found huge disparities. What's that? Did I give them a sneak?
Yeah.
We found huge disparities in both the generation that I've mentioned, as well as the consumption of data. So just to give you a simple example of this, when equipment is broken in the network, it's logged. Typically, there are faults that are reported. So somebody will phone up and say, I don't have power. So that's at one end of it. And then if we find a piece of equipment that is actually defective, in order to repair that, there's a work order process that goes on that can take up to 6 months to get into any system. There's a whole paper process and time and dispatch. So the consumption is almost what we need to know today, but the data is only going to come out in 6 months. So we had a lot of those challenges. But again, that's what keeps it interesting. Right?
It's funny because when you're in the organization for a long time, you look at those challenges and you say, that's normal. Well, it's not. So it's that external view that we get in this kind of projects that wakes you up a bit. So in terms of complexity in the environment, what do you think was the most complex thing you saw there?
I would say the most complex thing was was working with telemetry data. Mm-hmm. And trying to get the ETL functions to run in a timely manner that everyone knew that they may be looking at some information that was just produced yesterday, mm-hmm. and make sure that they're comparing that with the correct results or data that may have come, for example, from work orders, which were six months old. GIS, though, and we really still have great partners on the project around GIS. GIS is by nature complex. We highlighted there were a few folks here with GIS background. And we'll talk to it a little bit later in the presentation, is how we brought that GIS information, which is metadata rich, into a well-structured dimensional model with normalized data where we didn't lose any value of what GIS presents to us and what we can get from sort of typical analytics. Mm. The elephant?
Why do we have that? Yeah, that's you.
Oh, that could be the first question. Let's see. Who knows why we have an elephant standing on its trunk? Which, by the way, if we could achieve, we wouldn't probably need to work too much. Yeah. Anyone?
No.
No. No. So there's an analogy, right? Yeah, you know. What's that? Small footprint. Yeah. No, you get a prize anyway.
That's another one.
That was a good answer. But
it all depends on what side of the elephant you look at.
Get in there.
That's also yeah. Good.
Get yes. In there.
There you go. There you go. And interestingly enough, this is a little toy. So you can give it to that. I think that gent deserves something as well. You'll see that this little toy that we discovered to try and represent what we were trying to achieve. It's one of these little puzzles. Once you've cracked it, you kind of get it. But until then, it's fine. You'll see also we've adopted a layered approach, which we'll talk to as well. So the little toy that we have is just almost just a metaphor of the project we went. And yes, you're right. There's only one way to do this, and it's one bite at a time.
Yeah.
which is what we've done.
I'll talk about the geospatial side of this project, because I had a long GIS background coming into this project. So anyone will like to rate the complexity of GIS in terms of data models and structures and understanding that tend to be high in terms of, you know, different vertical systems, because GIS has that spatial component to it, but also the way the data is structured to be able to navigate and relate objects within the data set makes it a challenge from a BI perspective. So the nature of the data is already complex, but add on top of that, one of the problems that we had as a company that coming together from four different smaller companies over the years, you had different granularities in terms of how you describe the data from one region to the other, from one asset type to another. The data wasn't there. It's not complete across the board, so there's not a common view of how well structured, how complete, how accurate the data is. And add on top of the normal data quality challenge, the fact that we wanted to take that spatial component from GIS and forget about GIS and go all the way down to a BI model and BI front end and still keep the spatial component in it. So it is a challenge. And to be honest, I haven't seen anyone doing this kind of, we haven't, and we're working on it at this point. Because there's several approaches there, but not when you wanna talk about millions of records and snapshots, as we're gonna see later. So it's really the trickiest part of this challenge was to take that geospatial component down the right.
Yeah, perhaps I can show an example of how we've done that. So we've coined the term geodimensional, where we've taken the geospatial data and we've managed to model it in a dimensional model. Now, there may be other ways to do this. We've just found this to be the most effective way. So we're just using a very, very vanilla example, very generic. This is not real data, but it is a representation of the problem. So what we have here is a map, obviously. It's a Bing map. Let's get that recorded. I've just highlighted, just for the sake of the discussion, that pink area that you see there is a polygon. So you're all aware that in geospatial terms, there's three base components in a geospatial environment. There's a polygon, which is a shape that defines a certain area in space. There's a line, which is naturally a line, a cable, a road, etc. And then there's a point, an actual point in space. Now, probably most of our exposure has been to the point in space using the likes of Bing Maps and other map providers to find a restaurant, to find a place, or to get directions to a place. But those are the three base units. So what you see here on this map is a polygon which, for the sake of this conversation, is the Taranaki Base Hospital. That's that area that's in pink. We have our point there, which is a location in space, and it's housed in a line, a polygon, or a street. We then have the information that is now no longer geospatial information, but does have geometry. So what you're looking at there is a transformer or an asset that we try to record and are doing quite successfully now in the solution. And that transformer has its own attributes. Now, for those of you familiar with dimensional modeling, which I would expect most of you are, what you're looking at there is four different dimensions if we took from the geospatial world into the dimensional modeling world, because they all describe things. And now we're doing an asset management or modeling exercise. Well, how do we do that? Because typically, there's no relationship between geometries between dimensions in your model. So we took a very, very straightforward approach, and we just created a fact that holds the relationship. So we have a fact network asset state, and you'll see each of the objects matches a dimension that we have, and then we hold the relationship in a fact table. I've simplified the fact table just to show one measure, which is count. So if we use this model, we can now see how many transformers we have on a particular street, or how many streets have transformers, how many assets in a particular suburb, and that's just by count. And then when we add our ubiquitous date dimension, we can manage our network state change over time with this very, very simple design.
Which is one of the key problems that we have now, is you have to keep track of where assets go, so that transformer may change its location in time. So you still have a way of analyzing the life of a transformer, or how a street changes, or how a feeder changes, which is not there yet, but it's giving you that ability to look at space as one component in a BI view.
Yeah, and all that we're actually recording is the relationship in this fact table. So we've covered that.
Yep.
Yeah. So, that's right. I just slipped my mind. The point that I wanted to make here is, in these dimensions, we still maintain the native geometry values. So we can still go into our SQL spatial. We can still do intersects. We can still do distance. We can still do all the resolution of the geospatial geometry that we would typically want. And we've basically got the best of all three worlds. We've got the best of the SQL world, the best of the analytic world, and the best of the GIS. All in a very, very simple design.
That's right. So one of the challenges here was the fact that we needed to fit this, if you want to click on that.
This one?
Yeah, top of it.
How does that work?
There we go. Yeah. We needed to fit this modeling into a bigger picture, and that's a galaxy. I wish I had visualization thing we had on Tuesday night to view this. So this is an overall model of all the key BI artifacts and the basic layout that they should have in within the PowerCo business data. So we have five key dimensions, five key dimensional nodes where we put all the goal-related dimensions, like assets that we saw are one of the key ones. The network hierarchy is another set of dimensions, location as in street and civic address type. So we had identified all these key dimensional, which are around the facts, and then you have the core facts that we need to model over time. So this is not something that we're going to do within this project, but within this project we're doing quite a few of those facts in the middle that you'll see there. So there are different types of facts that we're looking at. Dynamic snapshots, cyclic ones, and just transactional facts. So there is an interaction between what the project needs to deliver, but what the long-term view is for the BI map of the company.
Yeah, the danger naturally when posed with an enterprise architecture like this is the urge just to go away and build it. And come back with hopefully something that the business could consume. We took a slightly different approach where we looked at being able to produce, and this was really an instruction from the project manager. He wanted us to produce succinct sub-projects that were both autonomous, in the sense that they would stand on their own, and if we stopped any spend at any point in time, whatever we left behind once we'd closed the segment would be able to take care of itself and add value to the business. So there would never be any sunk money. The other thing is that every additional project that we embarked on needed to be complementary. So it needed to be autonomous and complementary. So even if that was the only thing that we built, it would be able to stand alone. So we took this approach, and again, that's the metaphor of this little object, is we decided to do it in layers. So there's a certain base level of dimensions that we had to model and a base component for the data warehouse. But what we did was we just focused on one subset of the business. We said, okay, you tell us what you need, and there's this high touch process, very iterative, going with the business to make sure that we get it right. We get them the data early. We get them the data frequently. We let them play with it in an environment where they can moan and complain, and not such a structured user requirement process in the early stages.
Are we building the first layer, or did we build the first layer? What was the approach in terms of how you approached it?
Well, yeah, we took the approach of finding what was the most important thing to do. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing first was to be able to put an asset on a canvas. And once we had done that, we knew that we needed to get the data to the business. I often refer to an experience that I had when I first came to New Zealand was, obviously it's the city of sails, there's no prizes for guessing that. And I went on a sailing course with Penny Whiting. I don't know, are there sailors in the room? Yeah, anyway,
no,
she's
one on a corner
one over there. She's a well-known personality. And on her course, she's also published a book. So before I took the course, I said, well, can I have the book? I want to read up. It's a kind of sailing geek merge there. And she said, no, I can't have the book. I was a little confused. I paid for the course. Give me the book. And she said, no, don't read the book because you don't have one simple thing. And that was context. And she was right. After I'd done the course, when I started reading the book, I had a better understanding of what it is I was actually looking at. And we took that same philosophy to the users. We said, yes, the most important thing was to get an asset on the map. The next most important thing was to let them play with it. Why? Because it gives them context, right? They know when you start saying dimensions and facts and measures, the average user just shuts down. Yeah, tech speak, not interested. But if you're sitting with them and they're sitting next to you and they've got a cube and they open up a dimension and they see the asset and they see potentially a value, suddenly everybody's very clever. Everybody really knows what they want. And so that was the approach we took, and then we brought in this process of actually doing layers. So we first focused on a subset of the business. We serviced them, if you like, and then we brought the other layers in. So yeah. It's all about that context.
That's right. So, and I think it was the right approach because being an asset management kind of company, the asset is the base, but that doesn't mean it's going to be the same for everyone. But identifying what the core anchor is in terms of BI modeling is a key piece that we, I think, would tick the box. And then build all the events that happen relating to the asset and the network, or the transactions that happen related to the network or the asset. So that's the approach that we're building, like with this balls. We're going to jump into the solution overview. So we're going to start getting a bit down to the specifics of the system. Do you want to do a walkthrough or?
Yep. So. The systems, as I mentioned to you at the start, we had no less than 12 source systems. We said the most important component was first to get the asset on the canvas and to get the asset to the users in an analytical component or in an analytical presentation format. So we focus on the spatial assets, and this is again where we said the other company that works with us is GBS and another smaller company called Locus. Really can't say too much about how good they are. They helped us with the spatial ETL. because that is really a very special skill to be able to bring spatial assets out and put it into a structured SQL format where we could just do a simple select of it. We didn't have to worry about, you know, how far this is from that and does that intersect this before we could get value out of the data. We then, once we had that spatial ETL available for us, we then started to have a look at other data, events data. For example, customer complaints, and say, okay, there's not always a data relationship between an asset and a customer complaint. But we do have a general sense of, well, if that customer's complained, we know because of the network state information we have in our dimensional model, we can track a high level of a relationship between something like a customer complaint and the asset. So events were our customer complaints, outages, faults defects. There's heaps of them. There's also transactional data. Now, transactional data is not external, it's internal to the business. So depreciation of an asset, for example, or doing a repair. And that's where we have
JDE.
Yeah, we use JDE, and there's there's a whole work order system that we bring. We bring that all into a central repository, which we call the asset modeling tool. And from there, maybe you want to take it, Igor, and explain the scenarios and the.
Sure. Yeah. Just on the special ETL, because I know it was kind of a new area in terms of ETL for you guys. We initially said we're going to use an ETL process where you do all of this, and didn't really consider anything special about the GIS component. But the more we work in this project, the more we realized a lot of the analysis that we needed to make was things like, you know, identify the presence of a certain type of line on a certain type of pole, and just a segment that's just on top of that pole, and how close that is to the next piece of the network. And when you start realizing that you have a level of complexity there to create real assets, but derive assets in terms of locations of those assets, you start saying that, well, that's moving away from your normal ETL. But at this point in time, you can do an SSIS package with a lot of integration into the spatial ETL, but identify that spatial component is different from your normal ETL process was key in this part of the design. And that allows us to go through with all the raw data from the asset, but also all the derived stuff that we get out of it. And so we get into this part of the process where we take the asset information and model that. And we need to create scenarios, and I'll talk about the scenarios a bit more later, but it's basically a way of analyzing and interrogating the data, not just from a BI perspective, but from building a way of, in this case, adding dollar sign to the assets that has to be modeled with rules and parameters that are into the hundreds at this point. Thousands?
Yes, okay. It depends what we're counting, but there's about 750 rules at the moment. Yeah.
So that's where this solution is a bit more than the typical BI, because we're basically having a rule engine built on top of that. SQL use all along this stack from the beginning, from the GIS down to the end as a technology, but it has been very useful in building these new models. And so we're going to talk about the models further down, but basically you create those models and create the an output of that scenario, and you can visualize that with the raw asset data at the same time. So it's having the best of both worlds in the single.
Perhaps I can just elaborate on one of those rules as an example. If you imagine the light pole or the electricity pole that's nearest to your house, probably most of us live in relatively accessible urban regions. Now, we were referencing polygons earlier, and the polygon is a definition of that space. So we have in our database a suburban polygon that probably covers an area very similar to where you live. there are also electricity poles, you know, close to Mount Taranaki, which is up on a mountain, and occasionally there's snow there. So you can imagine that if we were to cost replacing those two poles, you can imagine that the cost to replace the one outside your house is probably relatively cheaper than having to get people up a mountain and be able to change that. So that's why we needed the polygon information. So we brought that across. And then there's multipliers that apply to those to determine the relative cost of that particular asset. So it's not just a simple finance process, which you would find, you know, a car depreciates, you know, by so much per year. We have a very different challenge in the solution of being able to determine what is the real value of any asset in the network. Mm. And again, as Igor's mentioned, we have SQL throughout, and certainly we're making good use of the column store index that those of you attended the session before here, again, because of the data volume.
Yeah. And it's all SQL 2012. You want to, so based on the previous slide, have a look at all the components we have been using and more.
Yeah.
Here?
Yeah, I may have jumped ahead onto the slide, but essentially we use the whole stack. We use SSIS. Once the GIS ETL is completed, we then use SSIS packages to move that information into the asset modeling component where models and rules are run against it. We then use SSIS to move that into our staging and data warehouse area where it's then dimensionally modeled and accessible either through standard reporting and or cubes. So we use SSIS. And then from a presentation perspective, I think presentation, Igor, has probably been one of the bigger challenges for us. Because under normal circumstances, you would either be in a mapping environment, so you would use either one of the ARC tools. ArcGIS has different desktop applications for map integration. Or you would be doing analytics in Microsoft Excel and or, you know, pulling out reports through reporting services. And we are in the process of converging these, and so we've had, in the short term, we've had to use some proprietary applications in order to surface maps and analytical data, but we're making some of our own strides in that space as well.
Yeah. So one of the key pieces in terms of design is that we're delivering this analytics background data, but the front end is going to be multiple things. So it's not just designed for Excel or a SharePoint map or a table. Or a SSRS report. It's designed for all of those and more. So the challenge here was to be able to build something that was flexible enough to fit all of those with the spatial data added to it. So that's a big challenge there. Luckily, Esri came up lately with a piece that we're going to see that's the one we're using at this point just to do a proof of concept exercise.
So I mentioned earlier, one of the challenges we still actually have in accessing one of the data sources has to do with contractual issues. But a bigger issue that we've encountered with this project and with this particular industry, if any of you are familiar with the power industry, is regulation is a big deal. And certainly it's been a growing point for me as a consultant to realize just how important it is to be abreast of the regulation in this space, because it has direct impact on your revenue, doesn't it?
It does.
You
it
want
does.
To talk
so
to that?
You're not, you don't know until you hit it hard, is how difficult it is to be able to make a business in the industries. You have a really tight regulatory framework in place since the late 80s that's tightening year and year. So to be able to say this is the revenue that you're expecting this year, you have to justify that pretty much down to the asset level, what you're doing. So what your performance is in terms of the network, how reliable your service is, how much money you're investing in, how much the network is worth at this point in time, what's the cost of the capital. So it's a complicated exercise that we have to repeat over and over and actually justify all the decisions that you put out there. So this tool has a huge impact in terms of being able to visualize that those decisions down the road. And that's where we looked at the modeling side of this tool as a key component in that regulatory.
Yeah, and some of the things that we went ahead and built was when we run this asset modeling component, the whole system is self-documenting. So when we apply a certain one of those multiplier polygons, it's recorded in the data. So we really built a metadata-rich process because at any point in time we may be audited. So someone needs to come in and say, I just want to know this number, how did you get it? So we've got all the traceability and all the metadata around how that figure was derived built into the system, into the database. That's also surfaced through the dimensional model. So if you were doing analytics against any one of the values that you see, you could just simply include any of the descriptors from the model and say, I understand how we came about these numbers. So that was quite a consideration, and certainly I would encourage people looking into that, if you're not already doing that in your projects, is to actually include the thinking in your design so that it's accessible to the users. I think as our users get more and more educated, they're going to be wanting more and more of that to be able not only just drill down and see underlying records, but also understanding the business logic while they're doing the analytics, especially if they're new to an organization.
Yeah. And the lineage of the data. So how we if you want to kind of jump to the next one, how we do that is it's really simple. Is we take the data and we have a lineage control of what data comes into this modeling exercise. So you know that data set was created at this point in time related to this extract. So you have all that normal ETL process. But on top of that, you build rules and parameters that drive those rules that get combined into a scenario or a model. So at any point in time, you produce this, run this model, and you get an output that's going to say this asset is worth this according to this model that uses this set of rules with these parameters that were modified by this person at this point in time without anyone actually intervening in that process. So you get a full trace of every single operation that happens here. And at the same time, you get the flexibility of building whatever model you want, because this was the flip side of the trying to comply with a regulation, but also trying to give you flexibility, saying, how about if I find that whatever I need to do to this pole that's up in Mount Taranaki is not 1.5, but 1.7, because I've done my engineering exercise, and it proves that it's not that multiplier. So changing a parameter like that in a model is going to be really useful for the business to run what-if scenarios, and you can run that pretty much on time, as in on real time. We're talking about gigabytes here, so it looks really simple. Mm. It's not in the back end.
How long was it taking before we built the tool?
Months.
Months to
Months.
Produce a single value?
To begin with, you didn't have any what-if scenario.
Yeah.
It's just it is.
That's the report, right?
and that's it. So you do that once a year, and you leave off that copy of a copy of a copy. That's it. Here, it's completely different. So we're going to talk about the shift in terms of how you move here.
Yeah. So just in summary, before we see some of the output that Igor's going to show us, the solution encompassed all of the core business domains. So obviously GIS, which is really both a management as well as an information tool. Financial, which is, as I explained, sometimes fairly complex to do in this particular industry, is to work out the value of a particular asset. The regulatory, we've talked to a fair amount. The regulatory is interesting because the regulation contains how you're allowed to value your assets. Yeah? And then it regulates how much profit you're allowed to make based on the value of your assets. So there's a lot of work that has to go there to ensure correct performance of the network, as well as getting the planning spend right, because you need to spend in the right areas of the network. Mm-hmm. So we've been able to surface a lot of that information much easier and certainly in a far more consumable way for the customers.
Yeah.
Should we move on to the next one? Just show a slideshow of... and this tool you said is?
Yeah, so that's Esri Maps for Office. So it's basically a point of integration, this whole piece that we're looking at. So it's just an exploratory tool at this point. We're looking at faults here, historic faults for the network. And as you can see, it's very dynamic in terms of what you can see. There's a lot of back-end systems that fit these in terms of how you locate those faults in space, the geometric types, and how you link that to the spreadsheet. But basically what we're doing here is navigating in the map, and then at some point you need to be able to do the interaction between that map and the table that sits behind, or the cube that sits behind it. And that's the table that you have there in the background. So what we do here is we filter. Let's say we have this many faults, and now we're going to look at a specific type of fault, F1 to F3, which are more important in terms of the network impact, and we filter that. And now we're going to have a bit of a problem here, because this is a proof of concept, and I'm going to get a message that says, this laptop is struggling. That's fine. It's a laptop. It's not the real solution. But it's basically doing the filtering of all those faults that you see on the right side of the screen. There you go. That's my nice message. It's going to go away. And basically, it's filtering the map with those categories and finding and redeploying in real time the results. So there is that level of interaction. What we're looking at here is trying to build the same interaction both ways, is doing the filtering from the map down to the spreadsheet. And that's what we're working on now.
That's where we are, yeah.
And so in the map, you can actually look at the faults and try to analyze the patterns, which is something that, as I said, takes a long time at this point for the business to get done. And I haven't overlaid the network into this map, but that's just from a data release policy. But it's just some samples of the types of data that we can overlay here.
Just to put this in context, before the project, this to be able to have this level of interaction would take an engineer no less than 7 days to produce the data in order to answer the question, and it would always be outdated naturally, because it's first finding the content, it's then putting it into a format that makes some kind of sense in a spreadsheet. It's then scrubbing that to make sure that the correct values are in that data set. And then it's the ability to separate out the different defects and faults. We can do this sub-second now for the same engineer with, you know, last ETL loads data. So yeah, that might be yesterday or this morning. So it's really a productivity gain that we're seeing, not so much in the bottom line yet, but sure, that's bound to come. But what we're finding is that the engineer's not a data analyst. Shouldn't be spending 7 days with data, right? Should be spending 7 days looking at it, going, we can improve things if we did the following. That's what he or she trained for, and that's what they should be doing to add value to the business. So while the project's in its early stages, from a profitability, because a lot of, obviously, when you're making your business case, that's what you're going to want to include, right? There's nothing for us to report on the profitability side, but we are certainly seeing productivity gains in the use of people's time.
And I think that's the impact that we're getting from the business at the end of the day. Is the response has been really, really good. This is the last project meeting. people realize that change in terms of...
They all got one of these.
Yes. and they're really excited. It's not often that you see a performance engineer say, that's what I was waiting for this many years. Say, okay, that's good. Because it's changing that, you know, that really painful process from having to build the data to actually analyze it to say, no, it's already built. You just focus on what you need to do. And then they see the potential of this. They say, okay, so those 7 days, now I'm going to spend doing this and that and that and that. And then they start flipping, basically, in terms of the potential use. And then the last one is around the time to market. It's saying, well, you know, if you need it tomorrow, you can run a model tomorrow and we'll see what it's gonna do. So you don't need to plan this in terms of time consumption. Also on the wind side is the... So if you take this approach that we're thinking of, is the layering exercise is... It's extensible. It's not just these, I don't know, four layers that we have here. It's you can take it to any number of layers, basically. And that's where we see this going forward. Is people have started looking at it and say, okay, I can do this now. How about we add this other one? especially around the finance side, people already said, oh, now we need to do some real serious finance modeling there to start looking at how we're performing in terms of network. And that's good to see, is that people see that there is a potential of the use of the technology in a business without really.
Yeah, I think as well what's important to say is that the technology stack allowed us to remain fairly decoupled. Yes. As you said, there's the GIS component, and once it's there, we've got the SSIS component. And even in our design, when we're doing extracts and staging, we are aware of that complete suite and know that it doesn't just always end in a dimension, or it doesn't always just end in a fact, that once it's going through that process, we actually have access to those for other processes. So it's been very important for us to have this design canvas where we know where everything's going. Because we, as we're speaking to the business, we're finding new requirements for data we know that we're working with through the stages. So, yeah, that's also been a big win for us there.
Mm-hmm. It has. Also, and this is more from a project perspective, is, you know, it's that ability to have quick feedback with that layer approach from the guys actually using these. So it's pretty much like that picture, right?
Yeah, and here, you know, I attended the Gartner BI session presentations last year, and one of the CIOs or IT manager, I'm not sure what his title was, to be honest, from Toyota in Australia, had taken a similar approach, and they just saw such huge benefit from it. Instead of having your traditional design approach, which is, you know, build the spec, do the user analysis, build it, take it to them for testing, is we kind of turn it on its head, and we get them to do the testing as we're building the specification. So we're bringing them data all the time, and they have the opportunity during the spec to say, well, actually, no, we use the data this way, we consume it like this, not in the way that we were thinking. And that's quite interesting, because as soon as they're working with it, they start to realize that what they were saying is not necessarily what it is that they needed to get their hands on. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, they're not familiar with the technology, as we mentioned earlier, so they don't have context. And the other thing is that they have a strict way of doing it today, which is, you know, paper-based or Excel spreadsheet-based, and they've got certain processes that they have to follow. So we've really had huge win on rapid feedback. And you know, happy to talk through our process to anyone who is interested, because it really does work to be with the customer. By that I mean the consumer of data a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's not your traditional project development methodology in terms of saying it's agile or not. It is, but it isn't. It's a combination. It's really custom.
Yeah.
At this point in time. And as I said, one of the main shifts, if you want from a business perspective, also from a technology exploitation perspective, is you move from being just reactive to proactive here, is that people start looking at the data and the information and saying, well, what will I be able to do, instead of saying, what is this delivering me? And that's a shift. The technology allows that shift at this point, which is, it's very, very important.
So we come to the end of the journey.
No, not really.
Come to the beginning of the journey.
It's like that picture, you know. We're covered pretty much, I don't know, a few thousand miles, but there's a few more to go.
There's still some more to go.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about the cloud integration and some of the challenges we're facing there?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the layers, some of the balls are data sets are within the actual infrastructure. Some of the stuff that's coming down the line, it's coming as a feed from some other sources, like, I don't know, weather information, for example, would be a good one to mention here. And the solution needs to take into account things like integrating to outside sources. And one of the things we looked at is saying, well, where do we build that merging point of those external things? So we're looking at Azure for some of the data sets, SQL Azure here, and feeding some of the data from that as an entry point. We're also looking at the performance of this, because as you saw from my laptop is not a good delivery mechanism for this. It needs to be a bit more, I wouldn't say extreme performance, but close to.
Yeah, we want more responsiveness.
Yeah. So you have to remember that we're talking about millions of records into a single snapshot of one of those models. So people want to say, I want to model this now and have that within a few minutes or a few seconds. And that's a challenge here. So we're looking at using the maximum potential that SQL 2012 can give you in terms of database performance management. And the last one is around accessibility. As I said, we're building this pipeline and we're delivering that to whatever we decide to use. And that goes mobile too. So we're looking at saying, well, how do we deliver this into a tablet and have that same interaction between the table, the graph, and the geography? Good. And I think that's us.
Yep. So, as mentioned, we have toys. So are there any questions? Yes. Yes. You mean to actually access it, or once mm-hmm. you're already
surface
there?
Surface.
Yeah, it does pose a problem. We're in a fortunate position where the core user base of data analysts, or those that are data hungry, is fairly small. But what we're doing is, remember, our development approach is to get in their, excuse the expression, but get in their faces early on. So we're not building something that's unknown to them for their own environment. But we haven't really had a challenge with that. So it's been workshops, and certainly what we found is that it's become corridor talk. You know, the application has seeped out into the corridor, and we actually the other day had that experience, and somebody was walking past and said they can't wait for this part of it to be released. So it really is about creating a excitement around it as well.
Yeah.
But the structured approaches typically would be a wiki or putting it up on SharePoint, say, you know, this is what you can get.
And to add to that, we have a clear set of core data sets for the company that are maintained and documented, and systems are heavily controlled. It's a difficult environment. So as Dell said, it's not easy to get into some of them if you're an outsider. So there is that framework that's already there in terms of governance of data and teams that manage that. So up to a certain point, we assume that as a given in terms of the core of business functionality. Yep, in the back. There's a question.
He was interested. So.
Yeah, that's a very good one. Yes.
Why don't you pass it down?
Yes. Yeah, that's a very
that's a good
point.
That's a good question. Eh?
Yeah, so capturing missing data.
You get to choose. You can have the mouse or the ball.
Early on, and that's why we mentioned that, early on we realized that the data quality was a problem in terms of getting this system built, if you want. So we have designed along the way, and within the different steps, feedback mechanisms that will allow you to get the data. And we have actually gone back into the systems and fixed some of the problems that we have identified there. So even at the special ETL level, you already have check points. You have in the ETL, and you have down in the models where you see, well, this rule won't run because the data that came there is missing this value. So we're kind of really strict on that. So multiple checkpoints to check for different types of data quality problems is what we have done.
And in addition to that, once you've surfaced the data in an easy to consume way, the business users find the missing data quite quickly. And during our process of working with them, we actually sell that to them, if you like, as a good thing. Rather than they come to us in a panic saying there's data missing, we say, well, expect to see some things missing. Yeah, that's a good thing. That's part of a data quality process. Bring that back to us. Let's get the data back into the source. You know, we rerun the ETL and push that information across. Missing data that the user finds, provided it's been managed for them so that they know to look for it, can really be a good thing.
Pass this to the back.
Yes. 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 That's a brilliant question. The question is, because it's such a complex project, how have we managed to avoid scope creep? Absolutely, it's a huge issue. And to be fair, we've had some.
Yes.
We've had scope creep. It's almost impossible to avoid. One of the things that we have done, though, is we time box not only the project. So we state very clearly what this project plans to achieve. We also determine the business domain and what are the data components that will be influencing the project. So we time box that. But another thing that we've brought into our project, and we follow, we're not married to any particular approach, but Agile is kind of what we do. So we have daily scrums, as an example. That's one thing. But what we've introduced is every 2 weeks, the project teams have a show and tell. So in the project meeting, we get together and we make sure we see what was actually accomplished in the last 2 weeks. Sometimes that's not always possible because you're in the middle of things. But what we've been able to do to make sure that the project runs on time is to take that approach. And then we have very, very, very open dialogue. So as soon as something's going out of scope, it's certainly in a customer-vendor relationship, it can often be a he said, she said, or can become a bit of a tussle. But really, we've developed the relationship with the customer to a point that we can have open dialogue and say, look, guys, this is really out of scope. Mm-hmm. And I think more than any process, that's probably more important.
Yeah. And having a good project manager.
Yeah, we've got a good project manager. He comes into the meeting, tells us stuff, and then gets out our way. Yes?
We've adopted the agile approach to delivery as well. And the issue I thought is with the executives.
Yes.
The executives with the 12-month soundbite. What they're after is knowing when they're going to get that little piece of information and when. With an agile process, obviously, yes. Your agile changing every two minutes, every 2 weeks.
Yeah. So I'm going to summarize the question just for the recording, and we need to be aware of our time as well. We're right on time right now. The question is, the execs, in an agile project delivery, the execs get a little frustrated. Would that be fair? Because they're expecting their delivery, and they want to see. So we've got a number of ways of dealing with that. It still remains a problem, so we haven't got a magic wand. But what we have done is, with the involvement of the business users, we use them as a buffer between what we're delivering and the execs. Because if the execs come to us and ask, we're project orientated, right? But if they go to the business users can say, no, just it's coming. You know, we've seen bits and pieces, we know where it is. And again, we've got that very iterative cycle with the business users, and we use them essentially as a buffer between the project and the execs. And again, I come back to the fact that dialogue is just so
key.
Important.
It's key.
Yeah. Thank you very much for
your
time.
Thank you, guys.
Does anybody want these?